and those people seemed very unhappy to me. So my observation as a child was wealth brings sadness.
Or some kind of selfish connotation to that.
Selfish, sad, you know, very negative, all negative connotations. And so somehow if I end up with any kind of wealth, that is all going to be brought upon me as well. And so I've had to let go of that fear. I've had to redirect that fear. Fear can be very motivating if it's redirected. I also think we do have a fear of success. You know, women, and we've talked, you know, you've heard this a lot, but a man who is considered aggressive in a business, and I've seen it happen in my industry, 20% of the people in the securities industry are women, 80% are men. And when you think about a stockbroker in particular, your impression of that is what you see in the movies, these people that are hard driving and they're ruthless and they just go for the jugular, and it's this very, very, again, very aggressive, stereotypical kind of a profile. And that fear of success possibly the fear that somehow I will be successful and that I will be considered unfeminine. You know, that if I am really good at what I do, and there's a woman named Abby Cohen, and some of you may have heard of her, but she works for Bear Stearns, and she's one of the most well-regarded analysts, securities analysts that there are. She's if you watch any of the financial business week kind of shows, or business nightly business report, she's on there a lot, one of the most well-regarded, and her manner is very soft and feminine, I think, but she's very sharp. Well, she had to get over her fear of that, obviously, because she's a woman maybe in her early 50s who has obviously been doing this a long time, and she had to get over that fear. So we cannot be afraid that we're going to be perceived as, quote-unquote, a bitch, or someone who is aggressive. The other thing is, there's a fear of getting what we really want. Women don't want. We do, but we don't. We're very subtle about it. I want that new dress. But somehow we always feel guilty about the wanting that we do. And I think that is, again, very, very typically female. I think that my husband can sit down and read the paper, and I can be stirring up a storm around him, you know, cleaning in a frenzy, and he will sit there and read the newspaper, and I will look at him, and I will go, and it's not that I want to deny him the time that he needs, because he works very hard, but I wouldn't even dawn on me to sit down and read the newspaper until I finished everything, right? He'll just sit down and read the newspaper. Well, I wish I could do that. There's a part of me that admires it greatly, that he can just do that. There's a part of me that it makes me insane because he's doing that. But the fear of getting what I really want, what happens if I really am successful? What happens if I'm really, really good at this? What happens if I end up having made some great investment decisions? Then what? Well, you know what? Then I have more responsibility.
You know, one of the things I observed, because being single and dealing with some of the financial people, which are predominantly male,
right,
is kind of similar like going in to buy a car as a female and have a male salesman, that you know you have to be on guard because they're going to ask you a stupid question like, what color do you like, or something, you know, stupid like that. And I think for me, it's somewhat intimidating to go into those offices knowing I have to be kind of really read up and know what I'm talking about, or I'm just going to get slammed by these dudes in certain ways, or this perception they have because you're a single female male.
The perception they have.
Or they won't talk to you.
Yeah, or the time to invest in a stock that really isn't that good. But you know what I'm saying? It's like an underlying thing where there's time to thought, I need to bring a male in the room with me just so I can have more respect.
You know, I don't think that, I honestly don't think, I understand what you're saying, and I think you're right in the sense that you've hit something that's really important. A lady came up to me yesterday or the day before here in the village, and she must have been 75, I'd say, you know, in her early 70s maybe. And she told me, she said, can I go to a financial advisor and get a second opinion about my portfolio? And people have asked me that a lot, and my first answer back is, do you feel that your investment advisor is not doing a good job for you? She said, well, I don't really know. She said, but I feel sometimes that he basically doesn't respect her, that he might be just doing things that benefit him more than they benefit her. And so my answer to her was, if you came to me to give you a second opinion, what I would give you is what I view, how I view things, and it's going to be different than the way her investment advisor is doing it. So I'm going to put my bias on it, because we all have a bias. And I am not a great believer in, unless you really feel that your investment advisor is not doing something good for you and doing you a bad turn, then to get a second opinion is only going to confuse you, the way I see it. So I suggested to her that she start asking him questions like, why do you suggest that investment for me? Why do you think that's a good fit in my portfolio? What analysis did you do to make you think that this is something I might be interested in? Really basic questions, but what that's going to do to him is make him go, oh my gosh, this woman really is more concerned than she's been, and I'm going to have to work a little harder for her. And so when he makes recommendations to her, he knows he's going to get the questions that then will cause, he'll have to work a little harder. This would be true for men or women. But instead of being, feeling like you're so vulnerable and a victim of this, to actually ask some very, these questions are very simple. It's not like you really have to have done any research, but you're asking him or her to get you the information to help you feel good about the decision you're making. But we have to own that. And again, women typically will just say, okay, if that's what you suggest, you're the expert. Whereas very more often a man would say, well, why do you say that? Well, why do you think that? Well, kind of go back to being like my 5-year-old. Why are you doing that? Where are you going? Why are you, why is it? Very, very simple questions, but it allows you to put some control, and it allows that person to know that you're serious and also maybe have to work a little harder.
I work at a brokerage firm.
Good for you. Okay, good perspective.
The first firm I worked at was 9 years ago, and it was one of the high-level blue-blood firms. They didn't hire women. They didn't give women the sales test. They didn't accept in operations. And they played basketball, the haves against the have-nots. Mm-hmm. They posted the list of who got the highest.
It's always the
sales and who got the lowest, and they just
football pool. So football pool, yeah.
Even the guys were, but they played basketball, have against have-nots. Mm-hmm. The firm I work for now has got lots of women working for it. And the bottom line for brokers is know your client. So the bottom line for you is know your broker. And when people ask me, how do I pick a broker? Which I'm not an expert at. I say, well, you have to go and meet them, and you have to meet them a number of times, and you have to ask some questions, and you have to feel like you have a rapport with them.
I think it's, for women, I think for men too, and I don't think there's any difference.
I don't think it's as bad as car sales at all. I think there are lots of firms that have changed in the last 9 years.
Yeah.
That firm is no longer in existence. And there are a lot of...
Well, I know in my work plan, we had 403, so there's certain particular places you have to go to, so we don't have that choice. You know what I'm saying? Uh-huh. But so you talk to that person about your annuity, and it was between two, Prudential and Safeco, and I invest in both of them, but so...
But you can have an independent investment advisor, yeah. And that's what I would do. It's one thing to you have the guys who come in and tell you about what's available in the 401k or the 403b at your employer. That's one thing. They're going to just tell you what investments are available. It's a whole other thing to really get good advice about your whole picture. Yeah.
I'm going to go back to work in a couple of minutes, so if I could ask a quick question.
Sure.
I guess my question is, I don't have any investments, and I've always worked for a nonprofit, so I've always basically made enough money to get by.
Sure.
And no more. But I know that I can't continue the rest of my life with that kind of a lifestyle. So I guess my main question is where do you start? Because I'm definitely, is that like financial security? Okay, if I don't do something, I know that I'm going to be hurting. So I guess that's my basic.
My answer to that is a couple things. First of all, you need to live on 80% of what you earn. Now you say, well, God, I'm not earning that much. Well, then you have choices about earning. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're not going to work. Maybe you're going to work for nonprofits, but you're going to advance your skills enough so that you can be at a higher level within the nonprofit, so mm-hmm. that you can be a director or executive director or something like that, so you can really be earning more, number one. Number two, if you get to that position, then you have the option to help your board of directors see that possibly a retirement plan is really important. I have a client right now who's the executive director of a bar association. She has no benefits with that bar association. We're doing a proposal when I get back to bring in a retirement plan for the bar, the association itself. She's done an excellent job, and she's got great negotiating power. You can start into mutual funds with as little as $50 a month, $50 to $100 a month. And my belief is, and my feeling is, you give away money. You give away to support the things that you believe in and the causes you believe in. And you should give away 10%, but you should also save 10%. And live on 80. Now, again, that's hard to do, but the people who are prosperous do that. They don't live beyond their means. We have a very significant problem with credit, with debt in mm-hmm. our society. And it causes people so much. I mean, your quality of life is so drastically minimized by debt. It's just, I've seen it just ruin people's lives. Mm-hmm. So as young as you are, you have a lot of opportunity ahead of you. And the first thing I would do is I would just pay myself. And the way we say it in our industry is pay yourself first, though, again, as from a Christian perspective, it would be second. But pay yourself like a bill. Your savings is like a bill. It's not whatever I have left over at the end of the month I will save. It is, I'm saving this $100 a month, and I'm going to write that check first to myself. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to get that done. The other thing that I have shared all week, and I really, really believe this, is when you start having a tremendous amount of anxiety about money, give some away. Mm-hmm. And you say, well, God, I've only got $5 in my pocket last rest of the week. You know what? Give half of it away. Why? Because that's an act of faith. It is a tremendous act of faith mm-hmm. to give away at the point at which you think you have nothing. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, you are actually releasing, and you're saying, God, I am going to believe and trust that you are going to help me with this situation, and you will be so amazed at the result of that. I've seen it happen in my own personal life. When my husband and I started giving money away, and I don't, you know, it's, we give to the church, we give to the arts, we give to other causes that we believe in, you know, various children, various things and community activities. I'm real involved in the community, so things come up all the time that I can give to. But when we started doing that, we literally, it's not like we're swimming in money, I don't mean to say that, but we don't have a lot of financial worries. Mm-hmm. I don't, and I think it's not that we have all this money, it's that I don't worry about it so much anymore. Mm-hmm. I've been able to give that away, and my focus then can be on other things that bring me joy and that build community and that enrich my life and the people around me. So those are really the things that I would share with you. And if you can live that way, I really believe that you won't have a lot of money problems. Mm-hmm. But you have to be committed to that. It's too easy in our world to say, I want this and I want it now. And I'm not going to wait for it. Mm-hmm. And that's what this couple that sat here all last week, you know, planning for the car that you're going to need. I know that we're going to need a car 5 years from now or whatever it is. So we need to start planning and saving for that car now so that when we go to the dealer, by the way, best way to buy a car is to walk in with a check. Mm-hmm. Having already done your homework on which car you want, you walk in, you say, this is what I want, and they look at you, and it ruins their day because they can't do the pitch. But I've done that twice, and we've had so much fun doing that because it's just been, you know, very, very empowering.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I want to say that I really, really believe what she said about it doesn't matter what you make. Live on 80% of it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I work with a lot of people who say, but I can't quit my job because I have my WAC membership and I have my car payment and I pay $2,500 a month in rent, and I know you're not at that level. You're not at that privilege. But it's amazing what people lock themselves into.
Well, and I've had people, I have a friend who's a bankruptcy attorney, and And he is a good person, and he wants to help these people. His whole concern has been, now that these people are bankrupt, I really want to help them rebuild their lives. And he has referred many, many clients to me. I've not had one of those people become a client. The reason is they have no discipline. They can't. These folks made $400,000 a year, and they went through bankruptcy. The reason they went through bankruptcy is, you know, he said to me, well, you know, he belongs to LA Country Club, and he said, I can't give up my LA Country Club membership and golf. And I said, well, can you golf, you know, 3 days a week instead of four? Or, you know, 3 days a week instead of five? Wouldn't that be a compromise that would save you a significant amount of money per month? Yeah.
You have to look really good, too.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a huge issue, but obviously not for the people in this room. We wouldn't be at Holden Village if that was our issue, right? Okay, the other thing that in terms of getting, you know, putting yourself in a position, you have to know what your goals are, and we talked about this earlier in the week as well, but you have to know where you want to go, and you have to want that. There's nothing in my life that I've gotten that I haven't wanted, even spiritually. I have to want to have a relationship with God, or I'm not going to. It's something I have to want. So wanting, you know, again, we look at the notion of as a Christian, I can't want. I think wanting is misplaced. Maybe there's a definition that we're missing somehow. But you have to want something. I really wanted children. If I didn't want them, I wouldn't have them, probably. I really wanted a certain kind of career. I really wanted a successful marriage. Those are things I wanted. And if I hadn't wanted them, I wouldn't have them. So wanting, we talked last week about wants and needs. And that somehow needs are better than wants, and that's certainly true to a certain extent. But once our needs are met, we have to want to take the next step to not worry about money. And I can't think of anything. I mean, there are a lot of things in life that are very painful, and money worries is one of the big ones. I mean, it's right up there with relationship worries and physical worries and so on. So, you know, how many arguments have couples had, and how many marriages have been destroyed by people who are completely incompatible with money? Mm-hmm. One's a spender, one's a saver. And that's very common, but it can be extremes. So knowing what you want and sitting down with your spouse and really talking about it, and as you get older, you know, now that you've accumulated the dollars, you're not going to run out of money. How are you going to pass this money on to the next generation? Having that conversation. What happens if one of us gets sick? Who's going to take care of us, and what assets are we going to use, and so on and so forth. Those are all things you need to think about, and then you need to plan for them. Now, you may not be able to do everything all at once. I certainly don't think. I believe women can have it all, but I don't think they can have it all at once. That's where, to me, the misnomer is. It's, you know, oh, women can have it all. That's true, I think. I think we can all have it all, but we can't have it all at once. I can't be a full-time mother and a full-time career person and a full-time PTA member and a full-time... I can't do it all. But I can do all of those things in my lifetime, depending on how I set things up. You have to get good information. Women, you need to... I have said this week, you need to... I would subscribe to a magazine that you like. Money may be one of them, though. You know, I think that Money Magazine, in my mind, sort of the people magazine of the financial kind of world. It's very easy to read, very easy to read. It gets you started. It's not a place I would end up with if you're getting more sophisticated, but it's a great place to start, Money Magazine. I like Fortune because Fortune takes different sectors each month, and they view those sectors and give great stories on those. The Wall Street Journal is a great, great paper. It's not just financial news. They've got all these human interest and great stuff in the Wall Street Journal. But again, it gets you started. The internet, Yahoo Finance, great thing to get on and start kind of looking at and playing with. All of those things are important, but it has to be something you want. You know why? You're not going to do it if you don't want it. You're going to find other things to do. You're going to, you know, do crafts, or you're going to, you know, schlep the kids somewhere or whatever. You know, now I sit and I brought a stack of reading with me this big, stuff I just want to briefly look through. I can't read everything, but I skim and I pick the things I really want to read, and I read those because it's pleasure to me. But I don't have time to read it all the time at home. You need to become educated. You need to learn what your choices are. I am this. If you get nothing, there's two things I want you to walk away with. One is you need to save, and you need to save all the time. You need to be saving, and get it, however you get started, you just get started. But the other thing is that you need to learn what your choices are. You can't make good decisions when you don't know what options you have. If you do that, you are going with the default or the passive thing. I'll just let my husband decide. Well, who's gaining in that situation? Really, neither of you are. Because in reality, your husband does not want you to be in a situation where you don't have... He would be very sad for you if you ended up in a situation where you didn't have anything. Okay? The second thing is that if you end up, I mean, your husband wouldn't want that for you. And you don't want it for yourself either. So really, nobody's been served by that. So you have to take ownership to understand what your choices are. And if you don't feel it's something you're interested in, be honest with yourself about that as well. Not everybody's going to be interested in this stuff. And if you're not, then get yourself a good financial advisor who can help you. There are a lot of people that I work with who are very bright people and very, very good at what they do. They just don't want to be concerned all day about their money. And they want someone who's going to do that for them. And there's nothing wrong with that. But be honest with yourself. We're in an environment right now where there are a lot of books written on, a lot of self-help. We're kind of in this self-help frenzy right now. You know, I should be able, because I'm smart, to do everything. I should be able to, you know, be Martha Stewart and have my house look beautiful all the time. And I should be able to, you know, you name it, I should be able to do. I should be able to do my own taxes. I should be able to write my own will. I should be able to do it all. I should be able to be my own spiritual guide. Mm-hmm. You know, what do we need a pastor for? Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? I don't believe that. In my heart, what I want is my life to be easier. And what I want is for it to give me the time to do the things that I think are important, to have more time for my faith, to have more time with my family, to have more time to do the things that I enjoy. And if one of the things I don't enjoy and really have no interest in is this, then get yourself some help. And even if you are interested in it, guess what? You're not an expert. You don't do this all day long. So are you going to always be making good decisions? No, you can't possibly be making good decisions all the time because you don't have all the information. It is your hobby. It is your hobby. And there's nothing wrong with having it as a hobby. But when you're having to make, you know, I think I shared the story. I know I shared the story last week. One of my clients I met with before I came, he is a gambler. He had got an inheritance and put it all into the stock market, and it went down by about half. He buys and sells, and he buys and sells. And I saw his trading. I saw the trading record. He's racking up a lot of trades. It's all on E-Trade, you know, basically the internet trading. He's a gambler. And so I said to him, his wife made her very nervous, of course. I said to him in our meeting last before I came, I said, you know, why don't we take a portion of the money that you have and let you play with it? Give you the opportunity to really enjoy this because it is a hobby for you, something you really get pleasure out of. Let's take the rest of it and really invest it soundly for the future so that you guys will never have to worry again. And he goes, okay. Because I think deep in his heart he was nervous too but didn't have a way out. You know, because he had, his ego wouldn't let him have a way out. But because I was there to maybe help open that door, he had a way out. And his wife, of course, felt a lot better because she saw what was happening but had a hard time communicating that to him.
Do you think you'll be able to stop when he loses that money?
No, I don't. Yeah. I don't. Because
he's a gambler.
He's a gambler. And there's always the next one around the corner that could be hot. And his whole thing is that he has all these friends in these small companies that have all these insider sort of tips, which I didn't want to hear about.
Could be the next Microsoft.
Could be the next Amazon.com. Mm-hmm. Could be the, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. Right. Classes. You know, if you haven't taken a class in investing, you can go to your community college or the extension programs through the universities, they all have investing classes. Starting an investment club. This National Association of Investment Clubs, NAIC, is available. You can get it on the internet. They have all the stuff to start an investment club. I think that's very powerful. I think that's very empowering to women in particular. And I have a lot of clients who are members of investment clubs. Be a part of the decision-making process. We've already talked about that. Find someone who can help you. Find an investment advisor that you can trust. And how do you know you can trust them? Guess what? We have intuition. You go with that. You interview them, and you talk to them, and you get a feeling about them, just like we get feelings about the friends our kids are playing with. It's no different. You know, you just get a sense about something, and you go with it. And don't be afraid to take a chance. I have a slide when I do seminars that shows a woman who invested her $10,000 at 6%, and another one who lost $2,500, invested another $2,500 at 4%, invested another $2,500 at 8%, and invested another $2,500 at 12%, and at the end of 25 years, who came out with more money? Well, the woman who'd taken the chance. The 6% person didn't have as much money as the person who'd actually taken the chance. You're not always going to win. You're not always going to win, and that's okay. But you have to be on top of it. You have to be looking at your portfolio. And I don't look at anybody's portfolio, including my own, on a daily basis. I think that personally for me would be insanity. I had a guy in here a lot yesterday saying, well, you can see the trends. Well, I'm not sure what trends you can see on a day-to-day basis. I think you can see them maybe from quarter to quarter. But, you know, when you're so micro-focused, you miss the macro perspective. And I think you can really miss something by not stepping back and looking at the whole picture. So I don't do that. I review with my clients. We sit down at least semi-annually, sometimes quarterly, depending on the client. And we don't make changes in the portfolio. We do it about every 6 months. But again, my focus with clients is long-term investing. And I believe that every single one of us is a long-term investor. If you retire at the age of 65, how long are you going to live? What's your life expectancy? 20 years, probably? It probably is. So are you a short-term investor or a long-term investor? You're a long-term investor. So should you put everything into CDs? No. Because it just doesn't make any sense. But on the other hand, you shouldn't take more risk than what you really can tolerate. And what happens to people is that when you first are starting to invest, you're very cautious. And then as time goes on, you tend to get more cautious. And what usually happens is the pendulum will swing and you'll get way overly ambitious, overly risk tolerant. And then it'll switch back again as soon as you get stung. So somehow if we can not let the pendulum swing so far, we're really going to be better off. There's more money lost through indecision than making a bad decision. The people who don't do anything are the ones who have the biggest loss because they've done nothing. So I see that indecision, and what it is fear. What causes us to stop and do nothing is fear. And if there, you know, when you look at a Christian perspective on things, Jesus said, don't be afraid. You know, the fear is a very, very stifling and horrible thing that we deal with every day in many, many ways. We have fear about, you know, fear about getting fat, fear about, you know, fear about losing your hair, fear about, I mean, we have all these crazy fears, you know, fear about getting old. Well, the fear can stop you from living. And or it can really motivate you. And that's what I'd like to, you know, have you think about is what is my true fear with regard to money? We all have one. We all bring baggage. My parents grew up in the Depression. They were very, very poor. So my father has plenty of money, and my father does not have enough money in his mind. And that will always be my father. Doesn't matter how much money he has, he will never have enough. Because he grew up having none. So that's the baggage that he brings to his look at money. Baby boomers, I think, my parents wanted me to have a better life than they had. So I never really knew want. So now my perspective, I worry more about my kids, actually, because I had the stories of the depression. Now my kids, I don't even have those stories. They're not my stories. I share my stories, not my parents' stories, usually. So my stories are about, you know, oh, I had a great time, I had a great this, I did a great that, we went on vacation. You know, I mean, the stories of my childhood are very different financially than my parents' stories. So how do I instill in my children responsibility for money? And what fear do I bring to the workplace? I tend to worry about money, the not having enough thing. Being married to my husband has been great, since he doesn't care at all. I've had to sort of loosen up a bit on that. I've had to learn to just let it go. Start saving, even if it's $25 a week. If that's all you can save, you save it, and you save it religiously. You save it, you just save it. You don't stop saving it. Oh, this month I can't do it. No, you do it. You do it. Whatever amount you can do, and incrementally you start building that up. When you start seeing your money grow, you will never go back. It is very, very satisfying to see how your money can really grow. And then you start this, you know, again, you're starting to release the fear of that's an act of faith as well. In a month when you don't think you have it to save, by saving it, you've also taken a tremendous act of faith by doing that. That's very, very empowering. Managing debt. If you can't afford to buy it with cash, wait until you can. I mean, if there isn't anything that Holden Village would tell us, is that this is not a place, we are not a people that should be over consuming in any way, shape, or form. Clearly, if you don't have a car to get to work and you need to get to work, then you have to go get a car, and you might have to have a car payment. I'm not concerned at all about a mortgage, unless, of course, you have just decided you need this enormous house that you can't really afford. My concern, or even a car payment per se, but my bigger concern is credit card debt. You know, we use our credit. I don't have trouble with a credit card per se. What I have trouble with is when you can't pay the bill every month. And we use credit card for convenience. If you have trouble with credit cards, get rid of them. Cut them up. Throw them away. Get rid of them. Because that is going to cause you more pain and more anxiety in your life than you could ever imagine. And some of you may have already experienced that. If you have debt, you can consolidate it. You know, if you have credit card debt and you own a home, you can take out a home equity line or something like that. Home equity lines, are the interest is deductible, and it's lower than it would be on a credit card. So that's an option that I have recommended occasionally, though I don't deal, financial advisors really can't help people with a lot of debt. We're not debt counselors, we're investment counselors. So, you know, debt is debt, if you don't have the means to pay the debt, or you don't have the means to quickly pay the debt or reasonably pay the debt, then working with an investment advisor doesn't make a lot of sense. First thing I always recommend to people is that they pay off their debt. No good reason to have that debt in it, and you shouldn't be investing money, with the exception of the minimum that you're saving per month. You know, you shouldn't be investing anything until you get that debt paid off.
I had an interesting thing. My boyfriend, he doesn't have any debts, never had credit cards, and he came up with this obstacle until he established some sort of credit. I mean, he had to go out to get a credit card to come up in what he called the credit bureau.
It's a score that you get to. Yeah, if you have no credit history, it's really hard to buy a house. It's really hard.
Yeah, it's worked against. I mean, that situation has worked against him because he had no credit, no ability to buy a house.
I'm not suggesting that. In fact, interesting that you say that. I have some clients that I shared about yesterday who really were just very, very, very modest means people. In fact, below modest, I'd say. He worked, she worked, and they always lived just really probably paycheck to paycheck. He was injured, very seriously injured in an accident, and got a very large settlement. And so one of the things that they're paying cash now for everything because they have the money to do it. And one of the things I suggested to them is that they get a credit card and that they use it and then pay it. But they have to reestablish their credit. They have to get some good credit going, because that's only going to be helpful to them. I mean, there's nothing wrong with credit. if you use it the right way. It's a gift to us to use it, but what happens is we abuse it. So you're right. You need to have some credit history, or they have a scoring system on credit. Like if you go to buy a house and you there's a score that they give you. I think it's called the LIFO score, something like that. And if you have no credit history, you're going to get a lower score, which means you're not going to get the best loan that's available in the marketplace. And what you want is a good credit history so you can get the best loan.
Well, the other thing that happened to me, I was kind of shocked. I've always been brought up to have the bill you paid off at the end of the month. And you know, I've had credit since I was 18. I'm 40 now, good credit.
Yeah.
I went to go get buy a car, and they denied me because they said I didn't have the credit because I never had a balance. So I never had, you know what I'm saying? I didn't build up.
And there's something really sick about that. But the way these companies make money is on the interest. Mm-hmm. And if you're always, if all you're doing is using the card and then paying it off, then they're not getting the benefit. They're not making any money.
Right.
They're basically losing money on you.
Right.
Because you get the benefit of the card and they're sending out the bill and they've got all these administrative people that are doing all that stuff. And so, but... So occasionally, possibly, you don't pay it off, but I think that's an interesting, that's a very interesting one.
Well, I was able to get a loan from another credit lender, and so...
There's your answer there.
Yeah, so I got it, but yeah. You know, there again, I paid it off way heavier than what it should have been paid off, but...
But yeah, I think you go to another lender, and there are other lenders who would find that that's okay. That's a good point.
And more likely, you go to the lender that provided the card. If you, for example, if you were to get your bank card through CFIRST and then you went to CFIRST for your consumer loan, you would probably be better off than if you had a Discover card, because there's no financial institution tied into Discover.
Oh, so your savings bank. If you must incur debt, shop for the best interest rates. There are a lot of great interest rate cards out there and fixed interest rate cards, you know, at 9% and 8%. Shop around. You don't have to get the one from, you could get the one from the bank, but you might find that you get a better one somewhere else. I've also seen people, if you do have a lot of debt, transfer their debt from credit card to credit card, you know, to get lock in those 6-month promotional things. That's working the system to a certain extent, but the caution I make is that if you go to buy a house in that LIFO score, one of the other things that will happen to you is if you have a lot of credit cards, that can work against you because they view that even though you have no balance on them, it is potential debt. It can lower your score. So if you have a credit card you're not using, cancel it. And make sure it's canceled, which means you're going to have to order up your credit report every year or so to see what's on it. Because things can get on your credit report you don't even know. And I would cancel any card you're not using. I always cut them up, and I send them back, and I mail a letter. Please cancel my card. And I've had times when they didn't do it. Credit card companies don't want to cancel your card. Because they either get an annual fee or they're, you know, anticipating somehow you're going to use it. But I've had that happen many times. So be careful with that. Were you going to say something? Did you have a comment? No? Okay.
If they don't cancel your card, what is the bad thing on it? You don't use it.
Because let's say you have a $5,000 credit line on a credit card. And you go to buy a car or you go to buy a house. If you have all these credit cards listed, even though you have a zero balance on them, it's viewed as potential debt.
Oh, okay.
And so, particularly with a mortgage, if you have a mortgage, the mortgage company, of course, is very concerned that you're not going to be able to pay that mortgage. And if you have the potential, it's kind of goofy in a way because all of us can get more credit cards, but that's how they do it. Mm-hmm. If you can, you want to have as few cards on your credit report as possible to minimize the potential debt that you have. You can always get more, but of course, why do we need more? You know, my view is you should have a credit card, you know, whether it's a Visa, MasterCard, whatever, American Express. I know a lot of people who use their cards for everything and then get the mileage, which I think is a great deal if you can do that. Pay them off every month. And it's the only way you can get the mileage is to pay them off, interestingly enough. They're rewarding you for paying it off. The second thing is possibly a, I really love those ATM cards that are like, that are Master, they're not really, well, they are MasterCard sort of, mm-hmm. but you can use them as a credit card, but it comes right out of your checking account. Mm-hmm. I like that. I really like that because then I'm spending money I have. Mm-hmm. My problem with credit, personally, is that I will spend the money and I don't earmark money somehow during the month, and then I'll get this bill. And I never know how much, I mean, I don't keep track of it. I never know how much I've spent, and that bothers me. I don't like that. Unless I'm using it for my normal expenses, like I charge everything at the grocery store on my American Express card because I get mileage on that. And then I, at the end of the month, I pay it, but that's not hard because I haven't paid my grocery bill all month, basically. So, but you have to be careful with that. You have to know where your sensibilities are. I'm not very good at that, personally. So I have to be careful because I don't want to be surprised. Mm-hmm. I would much rather pay cash, but I like the mileage thing. That's a good thing.
Just to speak to two comments you made, one thing that some people do so they keep the credit cards but don't have the exposure is they write the bank and make sure that the credit line is kept low, say $500 to $1,000. And I will tell you there's another reason for that, and that is if someone forges a card on your account. We had someone go to South America on a card. But the other thing that I've heard fledgling people do with credit when they charge is in their checkbook, they do what you do with your debit account. They pencil in the amount
that's
they
what
charge.
I do.
And so they...
That's a good idea, actually. That's a great idea, where if you charge it, you pencil it in right into your checkbook so that you really don't have that money. Mm-hmm. We are out of time, but I'm going to give you a few other things that I really think are important. You need to understand your expenses. Really, really big issue. The only way, we talked about cash flow and net worth, but cash flow is simply income minus expenses. If you are spending more than you are bringing home, you've got a problem. You've got negative cash flow. You'll never get, it's not going to happen. There's no way it's going to happen if you have negative cash flow. Attaching a dollar amount to your goals is really important as well. Saying, I need so much money to do X, Y, Z. I need $20,000 to buy a car. I need $20,000 for the down payment on my house. Attaching a dollar amount to it is very helpful when you're trying to save for something. So you and a financial advisor helps you do this because it's kind of a complex calculation with inflation included, and you got net present values and future values and so on. But basically, if you can attach a dollar value, then you know what you have to shoot for. If it's this nebulous thing, I'll save, you know, whatever I can toward the new car down the road, well, you know, it's not a goal. You haven't put anything tangible to it. We're much better at meeting something if we know. I was always great in college in the classes where the professor would say, this is what you need to do to get an A. Then I made a choice. Well, okay, if I don't want to work that hard, I'm not going to get the A. I tended to get the A because I knew what I needed to do. The ones that I didn't like were the ones where I had no clue how to get the grade, right? It's the same thing. And we can decide that for ourselves. And then the choosing investments. In terms of choosing them, you need to think about, first of all, what's the goal? If your goal is short term, I don't think you have any business being in the stock market. It's too volatile if it's short term. Long term, fine. There's a tremendous amount of opportunity long term. Short term, it's too volatile. And I never, someone asked me on Dish Team the other day, I have $10,000, what would you do with it? I said, sort of like a doctor, you know, saying, my head hurts here. What do I do about that? I said to him, do you need this money? Do you need it right now? And you need all of it for school? He said, yeah. I said, put it in a money market account. And I know that wasn't the answer he was looking for. It was a very disappointed answer. He didn't like that answer, I don't think. But that's my answer, because I think you're taking far too much risk. If you really need this money and it's not money you can afford to lose, and your chance of losing money is minimized dramatically by the time frame that you're working with. So the type of investment, the link of the financial goal, the tax implications of the investment. You need to know what the tax issues are related. You can get into a great investment and pay a boatload of taxes that you hadn't anticipated every year. You know, and all of a sudden you haven't taken money out of the investments, but all of a sudden you have this big tax bill. That's not very good.
How would you know the tax issues?
Basically, anything that is an income fund, something that is income, bonds, mm-hmm. or stocks that give off dividends are going to be shooting off income. That income is taxable to you in the year in which it's given. Whether you put it in your pocket or reinvest it, it doesn't matter. You're still going to get a 1099 for it, for your tax. So I focus for folks who are looking for long-term investing and little tax, you go into growth, what are called growth funds or growth stocks, where they're reinvesting all of their dividends and their earnings back into the company. And they're not giving dividends, and they're not shooting off that interest to income. And I would clearly stay away then in that context from a lot of bonds as well, because bonds are designed for income.
Okay. So you're not saying, though, you would assume how much that would put you over the bracket for that year. You're not predicting how that bond would do in which...
You could potentially, depending on the kind of investment. Yeah, you should know, you should be able to project. You know, if you're investing in a CD that's at 5%, you should know what amount of income you're going to have off your investment over a year. Bonds are the same way. If you're investing in a 6% bond, 6% bonds are going to give you 6%. That's going to be added as income to you. And that's just how, I mean, that's, and the same is true with dividends. Now, dividends are a little harder. You might not know what the dividend yield is because they make a projection on the dividend yield, and then it may be different because earnings might be different. But still, you know, if it were me, or, you know, as I work with clients, one of the things I do is I'm very, very careful about the types of investments I put people into, for the tax issue. Mostly because, not so much because it's going to push them up a tax bracket, sometimes that's true, but mostly because they end up owing taxes that they didn't think they were going to owe. Mm-hmm. And that's a cash flow problem for them, mm-hmm. unless we can anticipate it. Or you have to liquidate an asset in order to pay the tax bill, which I don't want people having to do unless they're prepared to do it. Mm-hmm. Within your retirement plan, it doesn't matter. Because now that's growing tax deferred. So movement and choices within that, they matter in terms of balance and diversification of assets, but it doesn't matter with regard to taxation. So you have a lot more flexibility in your retirement plans to move assets around and without there being any kind of concern over taxation. But that's a big issue, and it's a bigger and bigger issue as time goes on. Question? No? Okay. The bill's supposed to ring, I think, like almost instantaneously. Sure.
When you said, okay, if you look for a financial advisor, what are the credentials you're looking for? You know, like your CPA and this and that. I mean, what is the credential?
Oh, God, that's a hard question because everybody says they're a financial advisor today. Right. I've had more people ask me this question than just about any. It depends on what you're looking for. There are really three types of financial advisors. There's one that's a product person, like a stockbroker. They sell stocks and mutual funds and bonds. Or an insurance salesperson. They sell products. That's their job. Mm-hmm. So that's one kind. The other kind is what's called a fee-only planner. If all you want is to get a plan, to have someone evaluate your portfolio or give you a plan, and you're fully willing to go out and implement that and make the investment choices, then a fee-only planner might be better. That person, you're going to pay them a fee, and they're going to create a plan, and then it's up to you to go implement it. And then there's a third type, which is a planner who does a plan for you for a fee, but then they also have the opportunity and the ability to help you implement that plan. Mm-hmm. So you have to think about what you're really looking for. If you want someone who's going to do the entire, you know, be there with you along the way, a fee-only planner you're going to see once, maybe, or twice. I don't know how, you know, often you do. You're going to see that person, and then you're going to have to be on your own. So you're going to have to keep going back, I suppose. To me, and the kind of work I do is that last kind, where there's a you pay a fee for planning, but then you also have the opportunity to implement with that person, and they can help you and guide you not only about the investments that you're doing there, but investments in general. Like I do a lot of work for folks in terms of their 401ks. What should they be invested in within the 401k or the retirement plan 403b? Mm-hmm. Why? Because I'm looking at their whole picture. Mm-hmm. We tend to look at our assets in isolation. This is my house. Mm-hmm. this is my 401k, these are my other investments, but that's how we tend to look at them. But in reality, we have a whole portfolio of investments that includes your property, which is real estate. So people say to me, should we invest in real estate? My first question is, how much equity do you have in your home right now? Mm-hmm. What is your exposure in real estate? Most of us have a tremendous exposure in real estate if we own a home. Mm-hmm. So do you need more real estate in your portfolio? Mm-hmm. Probably not, unless you're looking for a certain kind of tax relief, and then it can be very effective. But that's so it depends on what you're looking for. If you just want someone who's going to buy and sell for you, great. Then that's then a product person is a great person for that. And so that's how I look at it. And then I go with my gut feeling. What a planner's going to look for in you is commitment. Mm-hmm. Unless you have a certain amount of money, a broker's going to look at how much money can they make in terms of, they make their money by buying and selling, transacting. That's how their income comes to them. So they're going to be looking at a dollar volume. A lot of brokers have a minimum, $20,000, $30,000, whatever the amount is. A fee-only planner doesn't have any concern what your asset level is and really doesn't care. I mean, they're going to do a plan for you, and they're going to charge you a fee for that. Mm-hmm. So $1,000, $2,000, they'll do the plan, and that's where they earn their living. Someone like me works with you through the whole, through your whole life. It's a lifetime relationship. It is with a broker, too. A lot of brokers, there's a lot of good brokers out there. I don't mean to minimize what a product broker does. But I also see the industry going more together. Mm-hmm. I see a lot more brokers doing financial planning. I see a lot of that. I see a lot of brokers giving very good advice and have been very valued members of the family, so to speak. Within. So I think you have to go with what your gut feeling is. And whether or not you trust someone has to do with how you feel.
Never go with a rookie.
Yeah. Pardon me?
Never go with a rookie.
Yeah, well, the problem with a rookie is that possibly they're not going to be in the industry 2 years from now. And right. Then I've gotten a lot of clients who've been passed to various people. And I say to them, how'd you get this? Well, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Or, there's a lot of that that goes on in the industry. Sometimes rookies can be very exuberant, though, and they have different ideas. I think you have to go with and if you want a woman, interestingly enough, I think there are more and more, like you say, more and more women in the industry, and if you're looking for, then just interview women.
But one good way to meet them is what she suggested earlier, is you take a class, because a lot of those classes are taught by people, often they are rookies, but it's a good way, especially if the class meets for several weeks, to get a sense of what the person's biases are, and you have an idea of,
I've taken a couple classes. The classes, they seem to be self-motivated to join in with their firm, right, their company, and they're selling things. And, right.
But don't you think also it would be good to look for someone who is helping your friends who have similar risk profiles and goals?
I think that's really hard to know. I mean, I think that every single person is so different. Mm-hmm. I have never met
two people that were the same. Had the same situations ever. So I would never say that I am, my focus is to work with people who are at moderate risk. I would say instead, I work with people who are concerned about retiring comfortably and who have estate planning needs, which is really the focus of my practice. So those are the people I think, and by saying that, that means I have a higher level of knowledge than maybe other people do about those areas. Mm-hmm. And so if those are your needs, then you're going to want to find someone who has that level of knowledge. Someone who says they specialize in that, or someone who puts themselves out as someone who works with retirement and estate planning people, is sure as heck better have those things, as opposed to, my job is to buy and sell securities.
Yeah.
So I am...